Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 7th of February, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's an absolute delight to be with you. It is our first show after an amazing fun drive. And I know you've heard this from many other folks on the air, but let me just add to the chorus that we just thank you so much for making this such a quick drive. And 3.5 days in a lockbox, and we did amazing work. I know, look, we know the reasons and some of the concern and the fear. But at the end of the day, it was wanting to preserve this radio station as a news source and as a source of information. And that is so important to us, and we take that very, very, very seriously. And we're just thrilled that you came along with us in such record time. So we thank you from the bottom of our hearts, and we just are so happy to be back. Now, we have just, we missed four shows, and oh my God, there's just a billion things to talk about, and Jim Henler and I were just speaking about this, but I sent out stories about 9 or 9:30 last night of things that I thought we would want to talk about, just trying to kind of update us on where we are over the last several days. And most of those things have changed, have been overturned or been rescinded just since I sent them out. But they still remain stories, and they remain things that we want to talk about. And we'll do our best job. So we are going to talk about what obviously is happening in the moment today, but we're also going to go back a little bit and touch on some of the subjects that we've missed over the last few days while we were raising money. So here we go. Jim Henler is with us, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Sounds a little scraggly with a cold, but he's here, and we are thrilled. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Joe, and again, congratulations on the fun drive, although I must admit I'm a little bit disappointed because I was actually scheduled to be a volunteer today,
yeah.
And volunteering is such fun.
Yeah.
Everybody should do it.
Well, I don't know if you know this or not, but and you should probably reread your contract, but you're volunteering right now.
Oh, this is true. Different kind of volunteer. Yeah,
just so you know,
to be back on the roundtable.
Yes.
Answering phones, talking to the people who are saying how important WAMC is to them. It's just thrilling.
And you know who was here throughout the drive doing exactly that was Teresa Bourgeois, public policy and communications expert, who was on the phones yesterday and getting into these very spirited conversations with both those on the phone and the folks in the volunteers in the room. Teresa, it's a delight. I always love that you come in, and both you and Jim and all the people who come in. We have so many wonderful people from our board and so forth that come in and volunteer, and that's lovely. All of our volunteers, thank you so much. But it was wonderful to have you there. And so Teresa and I talked for a long time yesterday, but when I saw her this morning, she said, "I just want to let you know I'm more worked up today than I was yesterday." And I said, "Wow."
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll try to dial it back a little bit to not scare people, but yeah, I was up all night. But I do thank you to all the amazing members of this community who supported it. And I really enjoyed talking to the people who I spoke with yesterday. And we had our own little roundtable discussion among the volunteers,
you know,
while we were in between phone calls. So that was fun. But it's you learn a lot in talking with people. And so thanks, everybody, for their incredible support and for this station, because I know it's trite to say, but really now more than ever, this is crucial. It's crucial to be able to have these conversations, to be able to talk through it and learn from each other and figure out what we're going to do. And as our democracy is shifting, sort of at a earthquake pace.
It's just one of those things where you realize just how special the station is, you know, of what we do and how counter and different that is for most other broadcast entities, and it's the listeners who tell us that and support it, and we just thank them so much for what they do.
Yeah, it was fascinating listening. One woman, she said she was a big fan of the roundtable, but right now she just can't listen to it right now because she's still concerned. But she was maybe going to tune in today. Yeah. But she
hi.
if you're back, hello. But she enjoys like the gardening show and those kinds of things because it helps her in these challenging times. Which she said, I'll come back. And then another person, you know, it was just interesting to see, to hear how much this conversation means to them as part of the community and from everywhere. They were from all.
No, I know. It's all over the country. And the other thing too about what you said is like we understand. I mean, we're in the same thing. I mean, there's a point where you just have to say, okay, I'm gonna take a little breather here,
right,
and do something else and then come back. The thing is we'll be here.
Right.
And you've guaranteed that for the short term anyway. And here we are. So that's good.
Thank you all for all that you did and for being part of the community.
I also want to thank our dear friend Jim Ketterer, who is with us, a senior fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. And Jim is joining us by telephone this morning, but he was nice enough to take time out of his day to talk to us, especially about the USAID story, because that's such a big story. And Jim has a history with that organization, so I'm very happy that he is here and able to talk about it. But Jim, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you back.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm sorry to not be there with you all in person. You know, Dr. Seuss has a book, Too Many Daves, but I think today we have Too Many Jims, or just the right number of Jims, maybe. That's the new book. I'm here in Manhattan. I'm teaching a graduate seminar on diplomacy and with great students. You know, with all that's going on in the world, it really is helpful to see these young people and how impressive they are. I also just want to say congrats on the fund drive, and that, you know, the roundtable and so many of the other programs are a venue for different points of view. No one has ever said to me at WAMC, and or I think to anyone, you have to have a certain point of view. You have to stick to a certain set of talking points or anything like that. And we see far too much of that around the world and in our own media and other outlets. So WAMC is a special place, and congratulations to everyone.
Thank you very much, Jim. It means a lot. And yeah, we're not trying to fill like we're not casting a play. We're trying to bring in different people and different voices and trying to get and at the end just try to understand what it is that's going on. All right. So enough about talking about how great we are. Let's get to the important stuff and talk about how horrible things are in the world. We want to go to this story. I think there's so many different places that we can start, but I think I would like to start with the Trump administration laying off nearly all of USAID staff. This was officials for the agency were notified of the planned cuts. And on the same day, they learned about 800 awards and contracts administered through USAID that they were being canceled, according to people within the organization. The Trump administration plans to reduce the number of workers at the U.S. Agency for International Development from more than 10,000 to about 290 positions. The small remaining staff includes employees who specialize in health and humanitarian assistance, according to the people speaking on the condition of anonymity. A spokeswoman for the State Department, whose umbrella the remnants of the agency have moved under, did not immediately return a request for comment. Officials at USAID are pushing for less severe cuts, and they submitted significantly longer lists to the State Department of Personnel they deemed essential to carry out life-saving and other critical programs, according to two people with knowledge of their efforts. USAID officials were also told on Thursday that about 800 awards and contracts administered through the agency were being canceled. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who took control of USAID as acting administrator on Monday, insisted during a Fox News interview this week that the takeover was not about getting rid of foreign aid. So let's begin the conversation by me asking a simple question to Jim Ketter. If it is not about getting rid of foreign aid, then what is it about?
Well, that's a good question, but I think we ought to just take a step back and take stock as to what USAID is, what it does, what it means for it to stop doing what it does, and then through that maybe start to get some glimmers of what is going on here. I mean, just off the top, I just want to say that the actions of this administration, I think, are reckless, they're chaotic, they're illegal, they harm the standing of the United States globally, and we can talk about the details on why that is the case. I mean, this was an agency that was started by John Kennedy in 1961, and he made clear from the beginning that this not only helps people around the world, but also very much supports our own security and our own prosperity and the kinds of things that aid works on. And I know it very well because I was the director of the SUNY Center for International Development. We implement USAID projects all over the world, very large projects, particularly in the wake of 9/11. Also, when I was at the American University in Cairo, I worked on USAID projects. When I was with the U.S. NGO Amadist in Cairo, I worked on USAID projects. I know the agency well, the good and the bad. It works in public health, in agriculture, in education, in democracy and governance, on things like institution building, rule of law, civil society. You know, these are not the kinds of things that would lead one to think that what Donald Trump has said is true, that these are radical lunatics. That's a direct quote. The president of the United States described our fellow citizens who are working on these programs as radical lunatics. 14,000 people for the agency in 60 countries, and it's a mix of people. They have their own diplomatic corps, foreign service officers. They have civil servants. They have people in the countries that they're working in work for USAID. So in Egypt, the big aid mission there also has many Egyptians, foreign service nationals they're called, and then many contractors who are implementing these many kinds of projects. They work in very tough places. They work in the toughest places. And there is a wall in the USAID headquarters in Washington that commemorates the over 100 aid workers who have been killed in the line of duty. So these are our fellow citizens who are not off on some kind of, you know, touristic jaunt around the world, but really are on the front lines of doing the toughest work. In the public health area, you know, just to tick off a few things that ought to get people's attention if it hasn't already, the work on HIV/AIDS that was started by George W. Bush, the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, probably the most effective, successful public health program in the history of public health, monitoring Ebola, Marburg, working on malaria mitigation, bird flu. You know, these are things we ought to be concerned about, and we have been and working on it, and now those are all maybe going to happen, maybe not going to happen. They're certainly not going to happen if everybody is fired. And the State Department isn't set up to do this kind of work. It's just not what they do. Go ahead.
No, I just I want to get a break in, but this idea of 20 million people worldwide, this is just an HIV treatment, that the pause on the aid and the gutting of this agency could jeopardize the health of more than 20 million people worldwide, including 500,000 children. And why has that not rattled more cages than it has?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is just, you know, Americans in general, this is kind of out of sight, out of mind. The most Americans think we're wasting tons of money in foreign assistance. There's an annual poll that's done, and people tend to think we spend about 25% of the budget on foreign assistance. It's less than 1%. So I think there's a fair number of people who are just saying, yeah, it's a mess. We ought not to be doing this, and it's going to be painful, but so what? I think that's it's really massively misguided. And it's, you know, the public health stuff is the most tangible, immediate thing to focus on. But there's also just such many more kinds of programs, deep relationships, longstanding things. I mean, it's not an agency that's without its own faults. Every government agency has its faults, and it's certainly in need of reform. Even, you know, the Clinton administration thought about closing it down, tried to reform it. The George W. Bush administration tried to circumvent it. When Hillary was Secretary of State, she tried to rein it in a bit, understate. That it's been an area of concern for a long time, but you don't say, you know, oh, there's a light bulb burned out in the house. Let's tear down the house instead of changing the light bulb. I mean, this is such a reckless overreaction. And there's clearly something more and deeper going on here than just trying to reform our foreign aid initiatives.
I want to reflect on that and talk more about just some more of what more is going on and continue the conversation on this. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Jim Ketterer with us this morning. And we are, first of all, we welcome you back after a fun drive, and we appreciate everything that you did to bring us back. And here we are, as promised, and we have a lot to talk about and a lot to catch up with. We are talking about USAID and what is going on there. We've heard from Jim Ketterer on this subject. I'd like to hear from our other two panelists. And then, of course, we always welcome your letters. We'll have some extra time today, so we'll try to get to many letters. So if you have anything you'd like to write to us, please do. Panel at WAMC.org, and we'll try to get to as many letters as we possibly can. Panel at WAMC.org, Jim Hendler.
So, you know, I'd just like to add a footnote maybe to what Jim Ketterer has been saying, which is, you know, I think a lot of what's happening is just a lack of compassion. People have gotten so focused on themselves, they've forgotten other people. But if you want a selfish reason to support USAID, right, many of those programs keep things from coming back here. We live in an international world. If you haven't an outbreak of Ebola somewhere and you don't stop it there, we're going to have Ebola in America. If you don't stop the AIDS, PEPFAR, as Jim mentioned, was just one of the most amazing things we've ever done. It really completely changed the spread of AIDS in Africa, and therefore in Africans who are coming here for business, coming here for whatever reason. I mean, we're not talking illegal immigration. We're talking an international world where people work with each other. And so, you know, it just drives me crazy, because some of it is saving other people's lives, and I'm a big believer in that. But if you want to take it further, look at your own lives and how this stuff has helped make us healthier and better and, you know, raised our, you know, I remember growing up in the days of Yankee Go Home. Haven't heard that for a while, but we'll hear it again soon.
Well, let's go to Teresa, and then I have some follow-up questions to all of this. Go ahead, Teresa.
Well, I just want to say a few quick things and really would like, if you want to look at it strategically, the financial investment. So as Jim Ketterer said, it's less than 1% of the overall budget, a fraction of the 1% of the overall budget that's spent on foreign aid, foreign policy. But the question is, where is the money spent? So currently, a lot of it is spent in the U.S. buying rice, wheat, and soybeans. and other food from farmers. And so what do the Kansas Republican senators have to say that about this? What are the folks, the senators and the House members who represent the places where they buy the wheat or the rice in the United States? They have currently paused $340 million in shipments, including rice, wheat, soybeans have been paused. The wheat growers have talked about the millions of dollars in food supplies that have been paused. Plus, it's also who administers this. It's the Catholic Charities is one of the highest recipients of funding. It's Mercy Corps. Jim Crutter, you could detail this more. So not only does it benefit. Does it make the world safer and healthier, and it's the right thing to do? There's also an economic cost to U.S. farmers and others in this country for stopping it. And then, Jim Hendley, what you were alluding to is what they call soft power. And as I understand it, Trump does not like the concept of soft power. But there's data, and Jim Ketter, I don't know if you have this off the top of your head, I can't find mine, that for every dollar spent on this, you save X number of dollars in bullets and in soldiers. And that's why a lot of the generals liked it. So, Jim, do you have more sort of detail on that you can talk about, Ketter?
I know what you're referring to, and I don't have the specific details. But I can just say that we can already see that our adversaries around the world are just absolutely thrilled with this, because they also see the power of American soft power. They've seen the effectiveness over the years, and they've tried in multiple ways to chip away at it. And the Chinese in particular have become very adept at it. And you can just be 100% sure that as we leave this vacuum and don't do this work, that, you know, is all the public health stuff that we talked about, but it's also deep relationships that last over decades, that, you know, it's a small investment of money and a big payout in long-term good relations with all different kinds of people. And the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, the others will be filling that vacuum. And, you know, I just want to say one thing, too, that the kind of language that has come from Donald Trump and Elon Musk about this, that it's a criminal enterprise, that it's corrupt, they're radical lunatics. These are exactly the things that the Russians and the Chinese and others say about USAID around the world as part of their disinformation attacks on aid staff and aid programs around the world. I mean, our own government is saying things that are almost verbatim of the attacks that are used by hostile countries against Americans working around the world. Verbatim. People really need to stop and think about, how did that happen? What is going on here?
You know, I was thinking later or some point of bringing in that China issue. China has been desperately trying to move in on places where we've had long-term relationships, particularly Brazil and the rest of South America, Southern Africa, and a little less clear what they're doing in the Mideast. But what we see is that, and you know, I have to be a little careful what I said because I studied a lot of this when in outside the public eye, but a lot of our food security.
What does that mean?
I was as I've mentioned maybe once or twice or 100 times in the show, I have done some classified
okay,
work.
Okay, all right.
If I give details, I'll go to jail.
The spy years. Well,
no, but nothing's classified a lot of American food security, right? Our ability to have the food we need at reasonable prices, et cetera, is largely connected to what the Chinese are doing around the world. And this is like handing them the keys to the cabinet full of stuff that'll hurt us. Sorry, pushed that in metaphor too far. But again, it's just shocking. It's like
the poison cupboard under the sink.
Something like that. Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable that, you know, we're going to focus so solely on America that we're going to let some of the countries we've been most worried about take over places where we spent years and years building these relations.
The thing is that this is not focusing on America, because if they were really strategically, you know, looking at America's, the United States' strategic interests, it's not in our strategic interest to not have friends and allies and eyes and ears in these places around the world. It's not in our strategic interest to not be able to address these health issues around the world that can come back to the United States. If you want to be, you know, crass about it, it's not in our strategic interest to weaken the American farmers. Look at the last week. The President Trump, you know, said he was had the backs of farmers. He supported American farmers, but this, you know, billions of dollars in funding go to farmer food aid from grown in America, grown in the United States. In 2020, U.S. government bought $2.1 billion in food aid from American farmers. $2.1 billion in food aid. And so the American farmers are going to take this hit, and then also with the tariffs, right, with the additional tariffs, and the farmers are going to hit hard. So this is a double whammy against our farmers. And when asked, the White House was asked about the cost of this, you know, and their response was it was cutting programs that do not benefit Americans. Well, indeed, these programs do benefit. Now, are there grants and initiatives within AID, USAID, that could be eliminated? Absolutely. But as, you know, Jim was talking about, you know, no doubt, in any place there is, no doubt, in any business, in any government agency. But as Jim was talking about during the break, that they've announced that they're going to have congressional hearings on USAID, USAID programs. Well, you know, that is the way you do this. If you're concerned, you have hearings, you look at Inspector General's reports. Ooh, but they fired the Inspector General. And you hear from outside experts from all sides. You decide what it is you want to change. You have legislation to change that, and then you pass that legislation and you implement the changes. When we're still operating as a democracy, you know, with three branches of government, that's how we did it. That's how we did it a few weeks ago. Not now, apparently.
We have many, many letters, and I want to get to those. I have a question that I want to ask the group, too. So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll start with the question, then we'll go into the letters, and then we'll move on to other topics because there's so much more to talk about, and we'll do just that. Panel at WAMC.org will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I wanted to just touch on something. Both Jim Ketterer and Teresa alluded to this, and it's a big question, and we don't want to spend a lot of time on it because I want to get to listener letters, but so much of what we have seen over the last 2 or 3 weeks are things that have... We think even let's use the Gaza announcement and we see it. You know, many said, oh, he just was of the moment and he said it and nobody knew it was coming. Well, then, you know, you find out that it's sort of been in the works and been talked about for a really long time. And I'm just curious about what we know in this situation of because it seems like I think you asked a question like, why is this the first thing that they have attacked in such a way? And I don't think attacked is an overreach. What is it? What's the end game with this of why this particular program?
Well, I've read a couple of Jim Ketterer may have other ideas, but I've read a couple of different approaches on this. One is that there is a very conservative, like far right group who have been wanting to dismantle, you know, foreign aid for a long time. So it's in Project 2025 and other things. Some speculate because there is the polling that says, you know, that people think we spend 25% or more of our budget on foreign aid, and it's sort of that's America first kind of thing. And then And then there are some who speculate that there was this hearing in December, and I actually read the testimony last night of the Inspector General, and and he noted a whole series of areas that they were looking at and trying to reform. And then there is a line in there that talks about how they were doing an investigation of Elon Musk and his very lucrative contract to the Starlink contract for Ukraine. And it didn't go into detail. So some speculate that, you know, just like his anger against the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, for fining their company $600,000, he has a particular concern about that. So that's all speculative. I don't know the answer, but I thought it was interesting that one of the quotes from one of the people involved said, the biggest thing that keeps me up at night is that I see USAID's destruction as a test case, a practice run in how the administration can bend or break the law to get what they want. We are the canary in the coal mine. And I do think it's also important to not talk about just what they're doing, but how they're doing it, in the sense of, and I thought this was a chilling quote, that they're just wholesale firing people. They say they're going to shift from 10,000 to 300 employees. They're saying that Rubio said that they're being insubordinate because they're not being communicative. Well, the reason they can't be communicative is because they have been shut out of access of their emails, right? And somebody said, we've seen this sort of thing happen in evacuation of war zones, one official said. I just can't believe we're doing it for the flippant kind of political pageantry that this administration seems to be doing it for. And I think that's, you know, it's sort of, it's chaos. They don't seem to care. They don't seem to care about the impact.
They almost seem like they want it, right?
Right.
And, and if you really wanted to reform it, and this goes, we need to have this conversation at the larger overall, you know, that's going on in all the agencies. You would identify the things which you think are not working, and you would reform or improve or eliminate those. This is just a wholesale.
Yes, so Teresa, you know, Project 2025 had a 30-page section on USAID and didn't go anywhere near this level of cuts. They recommended changing things. They recommended cutting some staff. But, you know, we were afraid that Trump was going to be implementing Project 2025. Trump is bulldozing over things that Project 2025 specified, and specified as good things for the conservative cause.
Meanwhile, one of the chief architects of Project 2025 was approved as the budget director yesterday. Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, I just, I mean, I think what both Jim and Teresa said is right on. And just to add to that, number one, I just want to reiterate again, I don't think there's anybody who would say that aid is without need of reform. Both political parties, administrations, going back to Bill Clinton, have wanted to reform it. At that time that the Clinton administration was zeroing in on aid, they also, just as an example for us to look back on, they did make the sacrificial lamb in closing the U.S. Information Agency, which was our main public diplomacy arm of the federal government, folding some of it into state. A lot of the other things just fell away. And that's a cautionary tale for us. That was an enormous mistake that was done and should not have been done, and we haven't been able to really put it back together. So this is another rewind of that, but in a much more chaotic, reckless, and cruel way. I mean, just imagine if you are a Foreign Service officer, a diplomat working for USAID, and you've spent your life moving every 3 or 4 years to a different country with your family, and you're told now you have 30 days to uproot yourself, to end your career, to come home to the United States, and you're labeled by the president as being a radical lunatic and labeled by Elon Musk to be a criminal. I mean, that's just outrageous, absolutely outrageous. I want to just add one other speculation about what's going on here. Authoritarian regimes tend to really hate USAID because the way they do their work circumvents the control of these regimes. And whether it's work with civil society, democratic institutions, elections, et cetera. The rule of law, these are things that are not highly valued by these authoritarian regimes, but they are highly valued by the people who live in those countries. And so you can be pretty sure that those authoritarian leaders have been saying directly to the new administration, even before they were in power, you really have to do something about this agency. We don't like what they're doing because they're undermining our efforts at maintaining rule. And these are longstanding complaints for these authoritarian leaders, but now they have somebody in office in Washington who will act on those complaints.
I think...
Go ahead.
I
do want to get with the letters, but go ahead.
Encourage people to look at a Washington Post article yesterday, how an ex-State Department official fueled Elon Musk's attack on USAID. Somebody named Mike Benz appeared on the Joe Rogan show in December. But he has a very interesting background, shall we say. And it talks about how he worked in the previous Trump administration, but before that, he was an alt-right influencer, extolled the values of white identity politics, so on and so forth. But one of the things that he and Musk keep talking about is they claim that one of Musk's claims that only 10% of USAID money reaches its intended beneficiaries. But in fact, that's totally untrue. It's only 10% is directly, the rest goes through organizations. So 90% of it goes through organizations, 10% is given it directly. And so this disinformation and misinformation campaign is fueling people's concerns about it.
Let's go to letters. We have many of them, and we got about 5 minutes before we go to the top of the hour. When we come back, we'll get to more. I'm going to roll through them pretty quick, but if there's anything that any of our panelists want to comment on, please do. We go to Frank, who writes, I believe that Trump is cutting off the funds for U.S. aid because he thinks most of the money and aid goes to Africa, and remember what he thinks of Africa. So fundamentally, this is his racism about black people, pure and simple. And if Trump and Musk are violating dozens of federal laws with their unconstitutional acts, why doesn't Congress just send in the police and literally arrest both of them on the spot? Then we go to Peter. Chaos, distraction, smoke, mirrors, throwing everything at the wall and see what sticks with no adults in the room. But my question is, what do we do? There is no cohesive, coherent strategy to respond to what is unfolding. Chuck Schumer holding up a can of Corona and an avocado. Guess what? Not the answer. Again, what do we do?
I recommend you, there was a press conference, House and Senate Democrats went to the front of AID with some key former leaders of the organization and held a press conference. Hundreds and hundreds of people were there. You can see it on C-SPAN. It got some coverage. They've been talking about it on the House and Senate floor. We just need a lot more of that. I think we need to talk about the Kansas farmers. We need to talk about the Minnesota wheat farmers. We need to talk about its impact. So I think that's what we do.
Barbara writes to us and says what Musk is doing is state capture. USAID is just the first step towards that goal. Then another Barbara says, does anyone else see the irony in the party screaming save those babies about abortion and has no problem with letting millions of children starve to death? Or that the country getting a large amount of this aid is the one which Musk, not a typo, I meant that, he says mush instead, left to come to be one that he wants to destroy. Thank you for the discussion. It is always enlightening. Then we check in with Paul. Maybe I'm naive, but the timing of handing Elon Musk a sledgehammer just as we're learning avian flu has jumped from wild birds to cows doesn't seem ideal. Is Trump picking up where he left off as far as pandemics go? Polly writes, what is frightening is that GOP congressional members fear for their lives if they cross Trump. The recent pardons were just the cherry on the top. Their fear is real. Then we check in.
Joe, let me put a point on that. You know, Hegseth getting confirmed.
Hegseth.
Right.
Yes.
Hegseth. There were a couple of Republicans who were saying they didn't see supporting him. Musk funded through the Trump campaigns, you know, billboards saying, you know, tell them to vote for this, or we're going to have a prime. You know, we're going to primary them out of
Senator
here.
Senator Joni Ernst.
Do this thing on and on and on. And so, you know, what they've been doing is they've been using the power of having a small majority, to push things through by basically threatening anybody who disagrees.
I want to answer one of the others very quickly. Yes, a lot of the money goes to Africa, but we also need to understand it goes to Ukraine. And that they've cut off humanitarian aid, significant amounts of humanitarian aid to Ukraine, just as, you know, he's allegedly negotiating an end to the war. So, you know, Ukraine's supposed to be our side, and we've cut off humanitarian, a large swath of humanitarian aid and logistical aid to them. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll have many more letters, and we can spend a bit more time answering them and commenting on them when we come back. My thanks to our wonderful panel. My thanks to all of you who have written in. We'll get to your letters, and it's your chance to write what you have on your mind. Panel at W. I know it's been all bottled up for a couple days, so now you just get to let loose. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All of that will take care of some business, but first and foremost, we'll also hear from News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We're fresh back from a fun drive, and a very quick fun drive, and here we are. We kept on saying we'd be back to regular programming as soon as we made the money, and here we are. We have a wonderful conversation going. Jim Ketterer is here, Jim Hendler is here, and we also welcome Teresa Bourgeois. We're going through letters. We have quite a number of them, so I'm going through them quickly because I want to get to many other topics. Obviously, a lot has been happening over the last week. So let's go to Norma, who says, in general, Americans are too busy thinking about what chips and dips they should buy for the Super Bowl than to think about genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and firing of U.S. aid staff or the dismantling of their own government. Why aren't millions out in the streets? Where are the leaders and organizers? It seems like the Democrats have just given up. Then go ahead.
If you're interested, I know there's a group called Indivisible, and they have been having, they send out emails. People are organizing locally. I know in 50 state capitals yesterday, they had a public presence raising these issues and concerns. I know that the Democrats held the Senate floor for 30 hours in advance of last night's vote in favor of the OMB director vote. I know that they've been out in front of the EPA with some key senators and House members and others talking about what happens when they try to dismantle that. They've been out in front of, I think, today's Education Department, AID. So you are starting to see this, and if you get connected with some of those groups, if that's what you're interested in, there is more response that's building.
Good information. Jan writes to us and says, for decades...
Can I just weigh in, Joe? And I had a conversation last night with a friend here in New York who is working with the federal judiciary, and just to kind of take the temperature on their reaction on what's going on, and the concern, the nature of the conversations behind closed doors is what happens if and when the Trump administration decides to just stop ignoring court orders.
Right.
Yep.
What happens when Congress does not stand up? Somebody, a previous letter writer, said, well, why doesn't Congress send in the police? The Congress doesn't control the police. Guess who controls the people with enforcement capacity? It's the executive. And so if the executive decides to just blatantly ignore court rulings, decides to ignore and steamroll the minorities in the House and the Senate, what do we do? Then we really have a true constitutional crisis.
Well, and I think, Jim, that Washington Post had an article a couple days ago about U.S. government officials privately warn Musk blitz appears illegal. And there's a wonderful quote in there. So many of these things are so wildly illegal that I think they're playing a quantity game and assuming the system can't react to all this illegality at once, said David Super, the administrative law professor at Georgetown Law School. I think that's, you know, a lot of what we're seeing is that they're just trying to overwhelm the norms.
I agree.
You know, Trump has immunity to some degree because of the Supreme Court. His minions don't necessarily, but somebody has to be enforcing that. And, you know, the judicial branch gets to make the decisions, but they don't get to enforce them.
Yeah, and Jim Ketter, Norm Ornstein, the other day talked about exactly this, about what happens if they try to ignore the courts, and that he feels that we currently are in a constitutional crisis. And I think this really is a question of what the House and Senate Republicans are going to do, what the American people are going to do. I mean, this is the court so far have been the place, and I'm sorry, we're sort of deviating from the letters here, Joe, but... this is probably part of the next conversation, but the we've seen the courts are reacting in a way in which our, you know, three branches of government are supposed to work. But right now, one part of one branch, which is the Republicans in the House and Senate, are not retaining their constitutional authority, and they need to do that pretty soon.
I was just going to
go ahead. Quick profiles and courage.
Yeah, right.
I was going to say, CNN just had one of their little flashing headlines, says, China applauds end of U.S. aid.
Of course
like
they do.
Just like we were talking about.
And at the same time...
Yeah. Right on cue.
At the same time, Trump is railing against what's going on in Panama because he says China's taking over the canal, which is a distortion of what's actually happened. They're controlling the port activity, but they're doing that in the United States also, you know, for all the same reasons. But he's weakening the U.S. in that same, you know, arena, but in a different locations.
Let's get to a few more letters, and then we'll move on to other topics. For decades, says Jan, I've had a job that involves going to their homes to see clients. While my experience is anecdotal, not empirical, it has always struck me that it's generally the people who don't have two nickels to rub together who express empathy for others who are struggling and those who seem to be well off who comment, I think the money should stay in this country. Maybe this is why there is not a greater outcry. A lot of people have a lot, and they want to keep it to themselves. Thank you for the show. It has always been welcome. At the moment, it is a lifesaver. And, Jen, we thank you very much for that comment. We go to Cheryl, who says, from the time Trump announced his candidacy for his second term in office, why weren't the Democrats putting more safeguards in place? Was it blind hope? More should have been done prior to him getting in, and now it seems to be in a mess for another 4 years.
Joe, I keep hearing that, but I keep having to remind people that the Democrats had very small control over the Senate and the House, and, I mean, things were so tight. And remember, it takes 60 votes to get something through the Senate unless you end the filibuster, which would be disastrous. So, you know, I think what people are missing is that a lot of the reason the Democrats didn't do anything is because some of that stuff would have been a waste of time.
But the rules and the laws and the norms are there. But Trump and Musk and J.D. Vance and Peter Thiel and all of those other people who are involved in this, they are just ignoring them. And that's what we cannot normalize. That's why people need to lend their voices to this. We cannot normalize. This is lawless. This is ignoring the Constitution. Look at what the judge said yesterday. I know we're going to get to the other ruling, but...
Maybe. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, please. No, I really want to get...
I'm just teasing.
No,
go
but
ahead.
It's true. I got to stop talking.
No. All right. One letter that I love, and then we'll move on to other topics. This one is from Abigail... What's an 83-year-old woman to do? I've decided not to pay my federal taxes this year. It will go straight into everything I am appalled by. You know what? If they come for me, I'll have my cast iron frying pan in my hand and ready to go. Abigail, I love you.
Can we get her on the show?
We need Abigail.
Oh, we're legend. Not directly suggesting absolute violence. Legend. We're not suggesting violence. This is a peaceful movement.
83-year-old woman in a frying pan.
She didn't say what she would do.
It's like she's banging it. She's banging it. Right?
She'll make them bacon.
There we go.
Exactly.
It's not eggs. You might have birds.
That's right. Yeah, that's true. All right. Let's go to other topics and talk about things going on elsewhere. And
oh my gosh, we need more of her banging her pan.
I know. And just
give her a hug.
I mean, it's one of the things that we heard during the fun drive too. I mean, obviously, I mean, people are rightfully so. They're very scared and concerned. And as I think everyone in this room and on the phone is. And so
get engaged. Fired up, ready to go.
We do our best. Okay, so let's see. Oh, where to go? I would like to talk about the Fed buyout paused. And this story is that the judge has temporarily paused the Trump administration's federal worker buyout program. Federal workers now have until Monday, February 10th, at 11:59 p.m. to decide whether to resign with pay through the end of September, according to the Trump administration. A judge in Massachusetts temporarily paused the Trump administration's buyout program for federal workers Thursday afternoon, 2 days after unions representing more than 800,000 federal workers filed a lawsuit to delay the program's deadline. U.S. District Judge George O'Toole said the administration could not take further action on the program until a hearing on Monday, when both sides can present more arguments on the case. To comply with the order, the Office of Personnel Management extended the deadline for federal employees to Monday, according to a post from the agency on X. The change further plunged workers into a state of limbo as the administration pushes to drastically reduce and reshape the federal workforce. Federal employees originally had until Thursday at 11:59 to decide whether they would take up the offer to resign and be paid through the end of September. Now employees have an extended deadline for the program, but little clarity on what lies beyond it. As of Thursday, 50,000 people had accepted the offer, according to a person familiar with internal conversations who was not authorized to speak publicly. It remains unclear how the pause may affect those employees. Despite the order, the Trump administration believes agencies can continue to process resignations, and officials continue to cajole employees into the deal.
So I think there's two aspects of that. One is the overall stupidity, and we'll get to that later. But the other one is, it was pointed out that all you get is a promise that your funding will continue, that your paycheck will continue through September, which the minute all these people resign, the Trump administration can simply say, nah, we decided not to do that. So again, they're not even signing a legal contract that enforces this stuff. And, you know, trusting this administration with all we see going on is itself scary. Going to the other side of that, you know, people are used to not thinking about what the government does, right? You know, without the FBI and the DHS, terrorism is going to go up, right? Without education, you're looking at thousands and thousands of people who won't be able to afford to go to college, not to mention kids and high school students. I mean, and you can go on and on and on. The government takes on things that industry won't take on because they won't make money, right? U.S. has one of the best postal services in the world, partly because it loses funds. But it promises that everybody in the U.S. will get a letter from anyone else in the U.S. for a very small amount of money. Okay, fire all those employees. You're not getting mail now. Granted, that's a lot of junk mail, but that's also the birthday cards and the invitations and all these other things.
Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on what Jim was saying, and people don't have a sense of what the federal government does. He's quite right. I think people also don't have a sense of who federal employees are and where they are. They're, I think, is this stereotype of kind of the faceless Washington bureaucrat. And of course, it's the nation's capital. There are a lot of federal employees there. But guess what? They are spread across the country and, in fact, as we were talking about before, around the world, doing all kinds of things in all of the communities across the country. So if you just recklessly decide that you're going to try to reduce it without any kind of system, without any kind of sense, and with a real sense of cruelty involved, much less the failure to, you know, really make an ironclad promise of what you're offering, you know, this is going to have an effect nationwide. And I'm just curious, as Teresa was saying before, to what extent will members of Congress on both sides of the aisle step up and say, wait, this is affecting my state, my district. What would it take to get to that point? I don't have the answer to that. It seems like we've crossed many points past which I thought that would happen, and it hasn't happened. But, you know, you start closing down federal offices in West Virginia, Mississippi, and in Texas. Are those members going to respond? I don't know. Teresa knows that world better than I do.
Well, I think that, so for instance, and this is not to do with the buyout, but this has to do with the attack on the Justice Department, where, because this is a retribution for the January 6th cases, and I don't know why the law enforcement community isn't very vocal on this, because first of all, January 6th, those folks brutally beat police officers, so one would hope, and, you know, this is what I'm hoping to see, is that law enforcement folks stand up for that. But so, and then they pardoned all of those people who beat the police officers, and then other things, you know, destroyed the Capitol. And now they're going after those people in the Justice Department who prosecuted those cases. So they want to remove, it'd be about 6,000 people or so all around the country. So what happens for law enforcement when you remove 6,000 FBI agents who are on joint task forces all over the country and that kind of thing? One would hope that you would hear from the sheriffs and the police unions and others. What happens in with this particular thing with the buyout? If you want to reform an agency, if you want to cut programs, you do it strategically. This is just a wholesale slaughter. So what in three or four of some of the key people in the HUD, Housing and Urban Development, have taken the buyout because they feel that they may be forced out. But they are critical leaders on rental assistance and the mechanics of public housing. They are critical on housing and the development of affordable housing. So what happens when you lose that expertise? What happens at NOAA when the weather department, when those who provide information for us on weather? And so this is where I think we need public engagement, because we need to start bringing to light these stories so people have an understanding of the impact, and then ask the members of Congress, particularly your Republican members of Congress, do you really support this? Because right now it's this nameless, faceless, quote-unquote bureaucrats who've been demonized by the Republicans for 40 years. But if you start saying, do you really want to lose five key FBI agents in your congressional district who are key on these terrorism task force? Do you really want to, lose the funding to shut down the Head Start program, which right now that's happening. It's getting out that information and holding the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans accountable, saying, do you really support this? Do you really support loss of food?
I understand your point, and I certainly get it. But by the same token, we said the same thing. We were in this room talking about this years ago, saying, what happens when you say to your congressional representative and to your senator, do you believe that the 2020 election was free and fair and was decided by the American people? And yet,
I understand they're afraid. I understand they feel that they're going to be threatened personally. I understand that they feel that they're going to be threatened politically.
The ones who said, no, I don't believe it, still went on to be reelected, and including...
But this is a whole other thing. This is going in and closing down all of the education department. This is pushing out some of our most skilled FBI agents at the top who oversee things and in at the ground level, at the community level.
I agree. But what could be more egregious than trying to take over the Capitol?
Don't get me started on this, because I'll talk for the next half hour about that. You know, because
no,
I just don't, I will never understand. But these people, these House members, Republicans, these Senate Republicans, they were in the chamber. They saw what happened. These police officers protected their lives and our democracy, and they can't stand up for them now. They can't stand up for those people right now. Law enforcement all over the country should say, why aren't you backing the blue? And why are you, you know, Trump, okay, legally, he can pardon those J6 folks who had been gone through the legal process and who'd been incarcerated. But to go after the people who legally, lawfully got the information to prosecute them, that's a whole other thing. But
can I just say that I think we just have to be clear. A notable portion of our fellow citizens voted in support of chaos and cruelty and lawlessness and violence. There was no mistaking it. There was no mystery. Yeah. It was in front of everybody. We saw all the videos, and yet they did. We have to be honest about that and understand that's what we're dealing with.
But the House and Senate members know that this is not legal. What Musk is doing, he and his minions have no business being inside the databases.
We have a 30-second before the break, but yet they're not doing anything about it. And we waited for 4 years for them to do something about it, and then we waited another 4 years for them to do something about it, and they're still not doing anything about it. I mean, not just Musk, but any of the litany of things that go on.
So the Kansas senators are gonna sit quietly while their farmers are decimated?
We'll
no, they'll probably ask for some relief.
Where's that money coming from?
The conversation will keep going, even without you. We'll be back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 7th of February. I will say that most of the mail that's now coming in is in response to a letter from Abigail, who had her frying pan at the ready. Now, I did find out that through the course of seeing the entire email that I know Abigail, and she's amazing. So Barbara said, "Do not take we old women lightly. I am part of a group led into battle by a 94-year-old firebrand who has been a lifelong activist and spurs us to do what we can against this hostile takeover of our country. This includes writing letters and emails, finding ways to get our voices heard, marching, protesting, contacting media, and more. I don't have a frying pan, but I can use my tire stick."
Oh, man, I want you on my side. You're awesome. Yeah. But I do think everybody should pay their taxes. I'm sorry. You do need to pay your taxes.
Well, and then we have this letter who is questioning that. Christine says, seriously, what would be the result of people not paying their taxes at a protest? Would Trump turn his Homeland Security and Kristi Noem loose on arresting members of the cast iron pan movement? I'm wondering what would really happen if the government did not get its money, and that is from Christine. And
Trump is.
We don't want to encourage people not to pay their taxes.
They are very good points. But the other thing is, as they're trying to rush through the permanent use of the tax cuts, which were already stupid.
This is what we should all be focused on.
But, you know, so most people don't know this. They've made a list of the 130 universities in the U.S. that have more than $1 billion in their endowment and are saying we should be taxing that. Meanwhile, they haven't even started talking about people who make more than $1 billion. I mean, Musk makes $1 billion. You know, I don't have the actual number, but it's something like an hour to a day, right? And they're talking about cutting his taxes. So, I mean, it's like, let's take money from the things that have been really beneficial to our society and give it to a few really rich people. And that's what the U.S. voted for, and that's what's happening.
We only have about 20 minutes left, and I want to get to some other topics here. Mm-hmm. And, of course, one of the ones that happened earlier this week, which we were in a fun drive and didn't get to talk about, but is the president's remark on taking over the Gaza Strip and making it the Riviera of the Middle East. And the response to that was obviously very quick and very negative. And yet, I think that was on Tuesday. And then Wednesday was the walking back, right? Wednesday was the
staff tried to walk it back.
To say
that what we heard he didn't say.
But on Thursday, the president defended his proposal for the United States to take charge of post-war Gaza and resettle its Palestinian residents. He stressed that he would not deploy U.S. troops to the enclave, which he had said he would do earlier, as Israel's defense minister announced that he had ordered the military to draft a plan to allow people to voluntarily leave. The developments add to a swirl of confusion over the proposal by Mr. Trump to, quote, take over the Gaza Strip for the roughly 2 million Palestinians living there to move elsewhere. The forced deportation or transfer of a civilian population is a violation of international humanitarian law, a war crime, and a crime against humanity, experts say. Mr. Trump's plan has already provoked furious opposition around the world, with some critics likening it to ethnic cleansing. It is far from clear whether and how the proposal would be carried out, and Mr. Trump's comments did not resolve some of the biggest questions about it, including where Israeli and American authorities hope Gazans would go, how many people they imagine would actually leave willingly, and who would govern and secure the enclave. Mr. Trump's proposal was not vetted by the president's top advisors, and some of Mr. Trump's aides had sought to soften the president's ideas on Wednesday evening. But in an early morning social media post, Mr. Trump doubled down, saying that the U.S. and its partners were prepared to build one of the greatest and most spectacular developments on the planet in Gaza once Israel ceded control there. Quote, the Gaza Strip would be turned over to the United States by Israel at the conclusion of fighting. Mr. Trump wrote on Truth Social, adding that Palestinians, quote, would have already been resettled in far safer and more beautiful communities with new and modern homes in the region.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jim Ketterer, what do you think?
Well, you know, Donald Trump has a certain talent for these kinds of what appear to be utterances that are just out of the blue, that are completely crazy, and then, you know, there's the whole trying to walk it back and all of that. But there is often, and there is in this case too, something that he's drawing on that is longer standing. So, you know, 2 years ago or so, Jared Kushner was being interviewed at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and he talked quite openly about the possibility of Gaza being a fantastic real estate deal. And he said, oh, but by the way, you know, we really need to kind of clear out the people who are there. And as you said in the intro, Joe, that it does constitute a clear war crime. It's ethnic cleansing. It's a crime against humanity to do such a thing. And so to have a president of the United States to say we should facilitate a crime against humanity is hopefully something that's getting people's attention. But I can say to you that soon after the October 7th attacks by Hamas, I was hearing rumblings and rumors from people I know in the Middle East who were saying that the overall plan is to make Gaza completely unlivable, which is, by the word, a word by the way, a word that Trump used in his utterances on this, and that people would have to be moved out eventually because it's unlivable, and that it would be all be done under the heading of a humanitarian relief operation, and it would be done with the cooperation behind the scenes of the government of Egypt, as an example. Even though publicly they're going to say we oppose this, we couldn't possibly do this to the Palestinians, behind the scenes there are other things going on. And so we need to pay attention to the craziness of Trump and these things that he utters, but we also need to know that there's something deeper going on here about not just Gaza, but also, you know, things have really been on fire in the West Bank, and the green light that appears to be coming from Washington for the clearing out of Gaza and the annexation of vast parts of the West Bank. Someone just submitted a bill in Congress the other day to say that the U.S. government should no longer even be able to use the word West Bank, and it should be called Judea and Samaria. And, you know, we're moving in a very, very dangerous direction, dangerous for the world, also dangerous for Israel and Israel's future security if this is the direction we're going in.
Yes.
Jim, could you speak to the about the what that means for the region and how the anger that will fuel in the region and how it will make us more or less safe in the world because of this?
For sure. I mean, you just really hit the nail on the head. The anger across the Arab world is intense, and it's putting governments like the government of Egypt, the government of Jordan, they already have many, many Palestinians there. They had a civil war over the issue of Palestinians there in the past. They have to strike a very difficult balance. And for those who have said, and I've heard it said many times, well, this would just be temporary. Well, ask the Palestinians who are living in camps in Lebanon or in Jordan how temporary their relocation was. And it creates an unstable situation across the region, which is bad for those countries, bad for the United States, and I maintain also bad for Israel.
I agree with you, Jim, and you know, people listening to the show know that I've been fairly supportive of Israel's right to exist, not necessarily the way they've been going about doing it. But, you know, the U.S. has been so successful in the past when we've tried to move into an area where there's a large terrorist force who don't like us, little places like Vietnam and, you know, Afghanistan and on and on and on. I mean, we have a history of not doing well against terrorism. And here what we're going to do is we're going to fire a whole bunch of people from the Department of Homeland Security. We're going to stir up hatred around the world by groups that have supported significant terrorism acts like the October 7th acts, et cetera. I mean,
and they're going after CIA.
They're trying
to gut the CIA.
Yep. I mean, you know, again, we have a very complicated government that does a lot of different things, but people just don't really understand sometimes. So, you know, part of my answer is I don't know how we educate people more, but I think that's part of the answer. And, you know, if somebody's watching Fox News, they're not hearing any of the things we're saying today. And we have to start getting it out there. We have to start making it so that it's not just politics, right? If you fire half of the TSA agents, then it's going to take you twice as long to get on the airplane. I mean, you know, it's,
if you go after the FAA and the control folks,
yeah, then it's not
air traffic controllers, you know, it's not going to be as safe to fly. And now Musk is going to go and do that. But also, I think it's important to remember not just what he's saying, which is egregious, but what he did. He also removed us from the UN Human Rights Council, but stopped funding UNRWA, which is, provides humanitarian aid to the Palestinians. So at the same time, he's saying, oh, we have to help these people in this terrible situation. Oh, we're not going to pay for it, but we have to help them. We're not going to send troops. But of course, you can't do it without sending troops, right? Do we really want troops in Gaza? Do we really want troops in Greenland? Do we really want troops in Panama? Is that what people voted for? I don't think so. How do you pay for that? It's not right. It's not lawful. It has a high cost and a high negative impact. And he even wants to withdraw funding from the UN, UNESCO, the Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. I know we want to talk about data, right?
Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with our group this morning. We have a great group, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Henler, and Jim Ketterer with us. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We've got about 12 minutes left, and we'll make the most of it when we come back after this. Every once in a while when people do things, they get direction from someone and they say, oh, you know, do this with a little more emphasis, do this with a little bit more finesse. And Teresa, during the break, just turned to Jim Henler and said, okay, now your job is to just scare the crap out of him.
Because it's what I'm about to talk about has scared the crap out of me. We're not supposed to say it on the air. I was literally up all night because this has scared me so much.
Here's a warning for all of you.
Thanks for sharing that.
You're very welcome. I thought it was amusing. So
I am terrified about this little piece of information.
Let me just set it up real quick. But this is about DOGE and we've talked a little bit about Elon Musk and what has been going on there, and we'll certainly talk much, much more about it. But there is a Washington Post report that I will just read a sentence or two from and then hand it over to Jim Henler. Representatives from Elon Musk's U.S. DOGE service have fed sensitive data from across the Education Department into artificial intelligence software to probe the agency's programs and spending, according to two people with knowledge of the DOGE team's actions. The AI probe includes data with personally identifiable information for people who manage grants, as well as sensitive internal financial data. The two people said they described DOGE activities at the Education Department on the condition of anonymity due to the fear of retaliation. The DOGE team is using AI software accessed through Microsoft's cloud computing service Azure to pore over every dollar of money the department disperses, from contracts to grants to work trip expenses. Lower-level department staffers were directed by agency leadership to let Musk's teams access the sensitive financial data. The use of AI inside the Education Department, which has not previously been reported, shows how Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, which includes former employees from his tech empire, is tapping the favorite tool of Silicon Valley as part of its mission to drastically slash the size and function of the federal government. Okay, so how scared should we be about this, Jim Henler?
You know, the good news is I told Teresa before that I'm not totally scared yet. And the reason is because there's actually a government section of the cloud where they have a lot of that information already. Your Social Security number has to be on file with the Social Security Administration, things like that. What really is the question is, what are they using it for? What are they feeding it to? Are they using outside tools that are not in the protected government thing? In that case, you're starting to talk about having crossed seriously into illegality, and we know that this group has not been worrying about that. So on one hand, you know, AI is a powerful tool for doing these kind of analyses. On the other hand, misused or letting the information out more generally, if you're using a public tool, then that's when, to me, it gets really scary. And we're on, you know, I said to Teresa, I feel like we're on the knife edge here, right? They haven't yet crossed over.
We don't know if they have or not. We know they've been given access to it.
There has not yet been any public reporting that says that the information has moved off of the federal cloud. That said, I'd be stunned if some of the people involved in this aren't using some of the tools and techniques that they've used in X and Tesla, et cetera. And, you know, that's when we'll see those leaks. And that's where the illegality is. And, you know, I agree with you. That's scary. Because if that information gets out into the public, that's a lot of personal information.
But isn't the overall concern the fact that Elon Musk, who is not a federal, like, we don't even know what his status is within the federal government.
They gave him some temporary status because somebody complained about that, but he hasn't gone through the typical background checks, looking for conflicts of interest, of which there are many. But he has these four minions, one of whom he had to leave yesterday.
Yes, because of the horrible attacks that were found. So that's the scary part too, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, what they're doing everywhere is scary. I'm saying the fact that they're using AI as a tool is
What worries me is if
that information gets out, that's when laws have been broken. That's when the genie is out of the bottle and can't be put in.
That may well happen. We just don't know. Let me just reflect on this for a moment, because I don't feel that Jim scared the crap out of us. So, Teresa, you do that now.
here's what I think the public needs to be aware of and possibly concerned about, which I'm terribly concerned about, that the Treasury Department, these folks were given access to the Treasury Department. When asked, they were told, the Secretary of Treasury said, oh, they only have read-only access. That turned out to not be true, not close to being true. So what happens when you have this highly sensitive, very complex system they got into in the Treasury Department? That's all of the billing. And they've had access now to Health and Human Services data. That's Medicare data. That's Medicaid data. You know, that's our health data. That's research data. That's all sorts of data, including classified data. They've had access now to the EPA, to the Education Department. Those are people's finances. So our finances, our health, all of these now, this group of people have had access, and we now know it's more than read-only access. What are they doing with it? What are the controls on them? Do they have any contractual agreements of non-disclosure? So if they did disclose, they could be held accountable. What are the guardrails on access to this broad swath of information that touches all of our lives?
Oh, I don't disagree with you on that.
That, to me, is terrifying.
That is terrifying.
But if you layer in not only access, but they're using AI tools on top of that, and so.
But that's just, Teresa, AI sounds scary, but really what they're mostly doing is using just mathematical tools to analyze what's going on. That doesn't bother me so much. It's that they can get the data in the first place.
But
there are a lot of laws that, if they violate those laws, that's when things start to get really complicated. So, for example, you talked about them having the health information from HHS. That's protected by a law called HIPAA, H-I-P-A-A. It is one of the strongest laws in the U.S. if you give out personal information.
But it's like,
and
but once it's out there, well, you can't bring
but
it back.
That's the problem.
Just like the CIA names. Once you put them out there, the FBI names. Once you put them out there, you can't take that back.
You know what we need? We have the bell that we use during the fun drive for new members. I think I need that now. Or a whistle. I'm not sure which I need.
Everybody needs to get engaged on this.
Can I
absolutely
add in, Joe?
Yes,
too?
Please do.
Yeah.
We have a minute. Go ahead.
All right. I just don't think that the people who are engaged in these activities with DOGE and the administration in general, they really don't care whether it's legal or not. Right. They have demonstrated their willingness to not follow the letter or the spirit of the law or the norms. And I think we need to realize the situation that we are in. And they hold the enforcement power. And they're not going to enforce it against themselves. My money's on Abigail's frying pan for what it's worth.
Yes, yeah, that's right. My money is always on Abigail.
Not hitting anybody, just banging it.
No violence. Okay, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody. And again, thanks to our listening audience. Thanks to all the volunteers. Thanks to the wonderful staff. Thanks for everybody who made the fun drive an incredible success. We love you so much, and you're amazing, and we so appreciate everything you have done. Coming up in just a moment, we will have a Black History Month special called Unlocking the Gates, How the North Led Housing Discrimination in America. My thanks to Jim Ketterer, Jim Henler, and Teresa Bourgeois. Thank you all for being with us. We'll continue after this.